You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Barry Yorgrau wears many hats. In fact, he is wearing one tonight. This former Angeleno, now a resident of New York City and Istanbul, is a performer, journalist, fiction writer, and perhaps even a hoarder? Question mark. It's a great pleasure, as I said, to welcome Barry back to Los Angeles. His hilarious and poignant memoir, Mess, One Man's Struggle to Clean Up His House and His Act, unpacks his efforts to get rid of the clutter in his New York City apartment once and for all. It takes us deep into a mysterious compulsion and its psychological backstories. How do we cling to the past, and how do we move forward? Confronted by his longtime girlfriend and beset by a possible mouse problem, our protagonist must at least tackle the dismaying clutter of his apartment and confront the talismans of grief hidden there. This is an existential project chronicled with black humor as Yorgrau attends Clutterers Anonymous, visits a Lacanian shrink, and visits England's most sensational hoarder. I think you might get a glimpse of him tonight, as he, Barry, unearths the stories of his own family history crammed into boxes under an unplayed piano. Barry Yorgrau is the author of Wearing Dad's Head and The Sadness of Sex, in whose film version he starred. He's also the author of Nasty Book, Subversive Kids Stories, and he's appeared on MTV and NPR, and he is the recipient of a Dramalogue Award for performance. And in conversation with Barry Yorgrau tonight is the inimitable Amy Bender, author of 5 delightful award-winning books, including The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, it's just so much fun to say Amy's titles, and The Color Master. You can read Amy's short fiction in Granta, Tin House, and The Paris Review, and you can hear her stories on PRR's This American Life and Selected Shorts. She teaches creative writing at USC. Please join me in welcoming Barry Yorgrau and Amy Bender to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Hello, welcome. Thanks for coming out in the raininess, post-rain. So Barry's going to start and read a passage that was set in L.A. or evokes a time when he was living in L.A. And so we were talking about what to read.
Yeah, anyway, first of all, let me just say I want to thank Louis Steinman and Aloud and the Library Foundation and Ken Brecker of the library for having us here. I think in these times particularly, these kind of institutions, these kind of settings are, as we go forward past January 20, a place of tremendous importance to us and for all of us together. So it's a real pleasure and very moving to be here, to participate here. Anyway, so.
That's nice.
So just very quickly, I first came to L.A. in the late 80s on a book tour from New York. I met a girl here. We both fell head over heels in love. I moved out here. A year later, she broke off with me suddenly and catastrophically. I went reeling back to New York, where things went really bad. But I managed to put myself together, and I came back to L.A. with my broken heart. So here's a piece about broken hearts, L.A., and not being able to let go. And there I am, back in L.A. again, rumbling the sunshine in my secondhand 1967 Dodge Dart. The nomadic lifestyle began in my childhood, goes into hyperdrive. In my three LA years, PD, post-dumping, I moved 25 times from sublets to house sits to friends' spare rooms, mainly from beachside Santa Monica and Venice to Hollywood's seedier lowlands and hummingbird highlands. Hillsides, pardon me. It's a precarious, crazy life, which suits me and my broken heart and my cracked state of mind to a T. I haul around only a suitcase and a box or two. The rest, mainly boxes of music cassette tapes and my review clips and such, I stash in my friend Tom's garage in Venice. Back in New York, I have still my storage space heaped with things from my parents and from my various relationships gone bad. What anchors my world those driven Dodge Dart days are my literary comedy readings at clubs and cabarets, my stabs at movie pitching, stab, 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 and a new book of stories I finally start on, fittingly titled The Sadness of Sex. Which will very fittingly and very sadly end when adapted for screen, come to a sad end when adapted for screen by a man who just filmed certain excesses of Michael Jackson. And I can't let go of my ailing second-hand Dodge Dart. Its transmission falters. Its brakes grow permanently faulty. A miracle I never broadsided anyone. And a bad gasket becomes so moth-eaten I chug through the fanciest blocks of Wilshire Boulevard, billowing smoke like a movable incinerator. Because I bought the Dodge Dart with my L.A. true love who dumped me. And she keeps me on a string to tease a madman's hope, a madman who's in group therapy now, beating his guilty breast, but she won't resume as I want. Mercifully, in 1991, she moves back to Ireland from where she came. The Dodge Dart continues to be my link to her and to my first halcyon vision of Los Angeles as a place where the days are ever balmy and blue-skied. You might say, La La Land. The other important reason I hang on to the Dodge Dart is this. I can't face the hassle of buying another car. The practical challenge overwhelms me. So I keep shelling out money for smoke-spewing, brake-pumping temporary patches. The Dodge Dart finally exits my life in 1993 while I'm visiting New York, book finished, mulling a move back there. The city of Hollywood tows the shambolic carcass from where I've left it gathering dust on a winding pretty lane under an orange tree. And just a few months prior to this, the very first academic paper on the condition to be known eventually as hoarding disorder is published by Professor Randy Frost of Smith College and a student collaborator, so launching this field of psychological study. Among other things, hoarding behavior is described as the sufferer's attempt to, quote, avoid emotional reactions which accompany parting with cherished possessions, unquote. A man who cannot let go. That would be me.
Thank you. It's a great passage to read. And it segues perfectly into my first question, which is, when you first go to Clutterers Anonymous, which is it's really fun to track in the book all the different things that Barry is doing to learn about all different kinds of clutter and hoarding and the whole range. Something that struck me that seemed so crucial is that you were startled by how much people were talking about quantity, right? And you were like, quantity is not the issue for you, and it was about quality of objects, which relates to what you were saying. So I found it really actually charming to read about the things you were keeping. And could you talk about those initially a little bit first, the kinds of things that populated this space of yours in New York, that the bags with handles, the postcards, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I went through a period in the wake of my girlfriend had a medical condition, I talk about it in the book, that was we had a tremendous medical scare with her. I mean, one of those sudden existential changes in life where you think the end has come. And it reawakened traumas I'd had. And one of the things that says that they say contributes to hoarding, people hoard as a response for, is trauma. Yeah. It's traditional. I mean, across every discipline of psychology, people did that. So the place, my place was, I use as a study and keep my clothes there. My girlfriend, we have a little compound. My girlfriend, you know, has a co-op apartment nearby. That's where I spend my nights. But so my place is kind of like a writer's studio. But, and we take a lot of trips together. She writes about food internationally. So I would come back, that magical word, ephemera. You know, little things that are supposed to be thrown away, pamphlets, you know, postcards, you know, announcements, museum brochures. I love bringing back with me napkins from certain cafes, that kind of stuff. You know, stationery at hotels.
But did it, like, what, did you have to love the cafe to take the napkin? You know, like, did it...
No, that's a good question. Some of them, for instance, I brought back napkins from Buenos Aires that were in Borges's favorite cafe. But other places were just like, you know, the napkin looked cool or was a famous place, one of the French cafes. But at that time, what started the book off was the fact that I suddenly found myself after this health scare, the ephemeral collecting is one thing, but after the health scare, I found myself just hanging on to plastic grocery bags, the most disposable thing in the world. Mm. And my apartment looked like a scene from a Roy Rogers film with tumbleweed going by, only... They were actually, it's a cheap production trick to suggest to people who are dressing a set. Don't use real tumbleweeds. Use plastic bags. And also a classic thing, naturally, for people who have a lot of stuff because things are piled up. I had lots of empty cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
Because every place where people have clutter or hoarding, particularly, half the hoard consists almost of all the things that you were going to use to put in to contain the hoard, and it just piles. You just start hoarding that.
But it's also, it comes up a few times too in a kind of a wonderful way that people say, you just have these cardboard boxes and you're like, but they're really great boxes. They're these really quality boxes. You can't get boxes like this
anyway. No, and one of the highlights of my experience doing, I decided to make my cleaning up my place a project. And one of the highlights was, as we'll see, I'll show some footage a little later, I went to England and visited the UK's most extreme hoarder, as he was known in documentaries and whatever. And he and I got into a discussion about the usefulness of cardboard boxes together. And it was great. So, yes, no, no, you know. And he also hung on to boxes because he said, a good cardboard box is really a valuable thing from the liquor store. You know?
Right, which is like... And then, so he... The one moment, what is he like? You admit this thing because you go to a meeting also in England, so you get what do they call that one? That's the has a different name.
It's a support group. It's like a peer group, which is Clutters Anonymous is a 12-step program where you cannot talk to each other, right? But peer support groups about issues you can have, which I found valuable.
Yeah, yeah, and that one you admitted this thing that also is. It just felt to me so interesting in terms of the nature of the kind of art made by the clutter. Like there's the space that you're in and it reflects all kinds of things, trauma and a love of beauty and a difficulty letting go and like this whole mix of things. And then there's this thing that you did when you would get rid of something. And this...
Not everything, but a lot of things. What I would do is a common thing that people who hoard, and maybe people clutter too, is that they will release something if they think it's going to a good home, yeah? If it's being taken care of. Whereas I, when I would get rid of certain things that were dear to me, would destroy them. I mean, I don't want to give away too much in the book, but I mean, I don't want to give certain highlights, but I will say one thing. There's a thing where I went through this cardigan that actually the girl who broke my heart gave me in L.A., and I cut it to pieces. I was the Sweeney Todd of cardigan destruction. And the cardigan was red, so there's and the scissors in the polyester could make squelch. So it was really kind of graphic. But I needed to, maybe it's because I'm a twin. If I can't have it, I don't want my brother or the world to have it.
It's, right.
And it's also something like you get it out of your life by you destroy the temptation. You know, it's like you throw the cigarettes, you know, in the sea, you know, or you, or whatever.
Yeah.
It's interesting, being a writer, there's a certain amount of shame that, being a person who hoards, or say, or has, there's a certain amount of shame always involved. And part of the shame is this. If you're a writer, you can have a bad, you know, you can have troublesome behavior, destructive behavior, that's alcohol, that's heroic. A drug addict, that's very darkly heroic, but that's some big deal. But if it's because you bring back knickknacks from overseas, you know, don't want to throw away a copy of a French rugby newspaper, you know, because it's a memento, then it's kind of like, you know.
But it's charming in this other way. Like, it just, I actually found both things, the keeping of these certain mementos and then the destroying of them. Different, and I think it makes sense that the plastic bags and even the boxes are a different layer. They're
exactly.
Like a broader, less refined
kind
of clutter thing. But then when you get to the refined ones, they feel just so interesting. And I even, like, I looked up the Picasso quote, which is... the urge to destroy is also a creative urge, because there's something about even ripping up the cardigan, it actually somehow reminds me of writing a little bit. There's something about that. I don't know if there's a way that you can make a link or it fits with what you're thinking at all, but there's something about that urge to, it feels like you're making it into something different. It's no longer a cardigan. It's now like a bunch of rags, but it's still a new thing.
Each
you know?
Man kills the thing he loves. The
yeah.
Coward with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. Yeah, the.
I mean, I don't know if it connects to writing directly, but just something about that impulse feels very active and engaged.
It is, but don't
really
forget the thing. This guy Randy Frost, who initiated the real field of hoarding studies, and there was hoarding. Nobody knew what to do with hoarding as an activity. It turned out to be a huge activity, and this guy was central in developing it. And he said, when I interviewed him, I went and spoke with him because his office was 200 yards from where my father had his office at Smith College. My father taught at Smith. So I really wanted to, you know, this is what I was doing with the book, was sounding these personal things. And he said to me as we were leaving, he said, you know, people who hoard are some of the most intelligent people I know. They have just extraordinary sensitivities to objects that we normal folk or whatever don't. He said, I think of them as artists. And I said, yes, but the difference is that one of the things that makes an artist is to be able to edit and cut.
Right, exactly.
And that, but, I hate to quote David Mamet in this day and age, because, but David Mamet says, when you're a writer, kill your babies.
Did you he know? Say it? So
yeah.
Many people have said, did he? Is he really the source?
There's a lot of child murder going on in the arts community. Yes,
kill
he did.
But.
And you get this tremendous cathartic emotional release when you're able to edit
yes.
and cut. You feel totally empowered, that you're empowered in something that you know. And so, yes, it is. There is something very cathartic. I must say, when I threw things away that I was attached to, I must say I regret throwing away the cardigan because I liked it. So I kind of think I sacrificed a beautiful sweater for my book project. but there is a tremendous sense of empowerment when you're able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And I think this was, you were talking to Frost about the new DSM, right? And how, the listing has shifted on
exactly.
hoarding.
And I trust everyone knows what the DSM is, the statistical movement. they never knew what to do with hoarding, and they used to call it compulsive hoarding. And if you hear people use that term now, it means that they're not up to scratch on what's going on for quite a while. It's no longer considered OCD at all. There are people who have OCD who do that, who hoard, but it's not considered itself. It used to be considered a subsidiary symptom of OCD. It isn't anymore. It's its own condition. And because it's not an obsessive compulsion, it's not an obsession, like a fear of germs and a washing of the hands. Mm-hmm. It's nothing like that. But what they say, what's interesting is that they've made the primary symptom now.
Right. This is great.
The inability to let go.
Yeah. The inability to discard, I'm quoting you, will now be the lead symptom ahead of excess accumulation.
Yeah, although probably excess accumulation is always necessary also.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see if there are people with very little accumulation. But I think once it's very little accumulation, it's not hoarding. It's just something else. Because don't forget, hoarding is a hyperbole of just totally normal emotional things. People sentimental, want to hang on to something for its use, or blah, blah, blah. Hoarders have the same thinking. Yeah. They just are kind of like, their throttle goes up to 180 miles an hour, as opposed to 65.
Well, and I think what's so relatable is we're all, right, I think on some level, there's just like this overrun of objects. So I think we're all in some way negotiating objects as they come in and out of our life constantly. And it becomes, or like even emails becoming kind of, and you talk about someone like some people do online hoarding, right? Like the inability to.
What do you mean some people?
Right, exactly. All of us. Exactly. But just that it's a very relatable thing. How do you manage that? But there's something about the language difference of this idea. The inability to discard is the lead symptom ahead of excess accumulation because they're so related. But the idea that ahead of it is that longing or that holding to oneself this thing that is dear, that it's just more emotional. I think what they did in switching it is they put the emotion ahead of the visual.
They did, although what he said to me, he's a very interesting guy, but in a strange revelation. To do this book, I had to dive back into therapy world, and it was shocking to me how cognitive behavioral therapy, which is focused on removing symptoms, has become hegemonic, become the lead thing. And but anyway, what he said was they really in their studies he's a very sympathetic guy, but he doesn't believe in the unconscious. That's one thing that struck me. Mm-hmm. I kept running into a psychologist. That became finally a standard question. I'd say, do you believe in the unconscious? And be amazed. And Randy Frost does not believe in repression.
Wow.
Doesn't really believe in the unconscious in any way that would have a Freudian, the way we think. No, doesn't believe in those things. But still has a great therapeutic manner and sympathy, which ultimately I think is what counts. But he said, in fact, they weren't able in their studies. He's an experimental psychologist to get 100% correlation to excessive accumulation. But he said those go together.
Yeah.
But they decided to put up the letting go because that's where the thing is. And this one guy, this foul-mouthed old veteran declutterer named Ron the Disaster Master Alford, who, when I told, I'll give one line away from the book, well, I'll give more than that. When I told him, I said, I'm doing this project, I'm making this project of decluttering my place and studying this thing. I said, it's almost hindering me from decluttering, doing the project. I said, and I've turned it into a kind of an art project. And he said to me, you're so full of shit. So he's a very, very direct talking dude.
Tough.
But he said, hoarding is what squirrels do. What the thing that afflicts people that he worked with, because he said, is what he called it, disposophobia. He said there are people who hang on to things they just cannot let go. And Randy Frost, I asked him, I said, what do you think? Why do you think people are that way? He said, we're not sure. He's lovely. He's very not. It's a condition which people aren't sure about at all, scientifically, as it were. But he said, it seems to be there's some kind of, for whatever reason, some developmental stall where at a certain age, young age, people start to get emotionally attached to objects in a way that other people don't. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was, I thought that was something of I thought that was very interesting.
And there were some links made to the idea of you moving a lot as a kid.
Right. A lot of people, one of the things that people who hoard, say, they report a lot of trauma, and they also report generally as a characteristic moving around a lot. So you hang on to things as a way of anchoring yourself. Having said that, the hoarder, the Richard Wallace, the UK's most extreme hoarder, lived in one house his entire life.
Yeah, interesting.
And the Collier brothers, you know what we're talking about, right? In New York, they lived in New York. They never moved around all their lives. So, you know, these things aren't hard and fast, but it is common for hoarders. It's fairly common that they move around a lot as a kid. And I did. I moved around tremendously as a child. And I can feel in myself that there's a sense of that, of hanging on to stuff. Mm. It's also, I just like, you know, I like ephemera.
Yeah. Well, and we can get back to Richard in a moment, but there, it almost felt like in the book, there's the focus on the project and the decluttering and the hoarding and investigating. Mm. And then it almost feels like the, I was trying to think of, is it the backbeat or the like counter melody, is that you're traveling a lot. And so we hear reference to the travel, but we don't go anywhere with you. We're based in your place.
Right.
But it feels like there's this really interesting and kind of meaningful, I think, relationship to you kind of in airplanes all over the world.
Right, right.
And bringing back things to this kind of hub.
Right.
And I just, I think, I was a little curious about that to ask you, do you feel like they're related? Like, I mean, moving a lot, it relates to the moving a lot, right? But just, do you feel like there's a relationship there to the travel or your kind of cosmopolitan appetite for the world, right? You're interested in the world and then you have like a little museum of it.
That I mean, I guess that goes into the next edition of the book, right? Part of it also is my girlfriend, I accompany her, she writes about food on a global beat. And so I accompany her on her travels.
Fun.
And I, you know, I'm still a naive about travel. You know, I love collecting all the little things where we are the nick. Because I have, you know, I'm like one of those people who likes these things. There are some of us who like these things and other people who care less, but I'm one of them who likes it. So I bring that stuff back. What became odd, the ambivalence in this was this. I had a very, my father was from Germany, and Europe became associated with him. And I had a very difficult relationship, which I write about in the book, with my father. So the ambivalence that strikes so often, I would bring these objects back because I loved them, but I kept a slight alienation from them because they reminded me of my father, because Europe was my father as a kid. He would go on travels and come back, and he was too. So the internal dynamic psychologically for me in my space, you think, oh, this is all consoling. It is, but there are these, all these, you know, it's the, these trip wires of different, you know, resonances and push and pull emotionally and wanting something and not wanting it. It, you know, we're really packed in on this, in this space.
And there, like, there was this feeling too, I think, as the book progresses, certain areas in the apartment sort of clear, and then what's underneath them gets unearthed, and then you have to contend with this box or that box. And I think I just found that, like, even you know, when you move and you think you've packed everything and then you open a closet or something and you're like, oh, there's, like, you know, 17 boxes I need to fill with this thing under the kitchen sink or whatever. Like, this feeling of the layers beneath the layers.
No, indeed. And also what happens with clutter and hoarding, but clutter, is it not only displays, it hides.
Yeah.
And I remember being in my apartment and thinking, suddenly surrounded at its worst. And you know what? Let me do now and bring up the first slide. I'm only going to show one slide now. I'll show the rest of the slides at the end.
Yeah.
But let me show what my apartment. I put together a gallery, a shock gallery, to show people on an iPad. So I'm going to just show you the first shock image I would bring, because I would show it to various health professionals and whatever, and writers and whatever, and say, do you think this is hoarding or do you think it's something? And I wanted them to both say, it almost looks like hoarding, but it isn't. You follow? It's like I would get the, I would have my cake and eat it too. Like, wow, this is horrible, but it's not hoarding. You know what I mean?
Then you'd be like a little disappointed if they were like, it's not so bad.
Exactly. And I was seeing this Lacanian shrink, and she said, oh, it looks like someone's working there. I said, what are you talking about? And then I took it to someone else, and they said, no, geez, it looks like hoarding. I said, but low-level hoarding, right? He said, yes, low-level hoarding. So, but this was at its worst when I hadn't gotten rid of, in the early stages, I was able to get rid of the plastic bags and the boxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of them. So this was, as I say, shock value, yeah? We're trying to sell a book here, so we had to, you know, you have to have something. You can't have people go, oh, that doesn't look so bad. Nobody's going to, you know. So this is
what... But it's
true
that it's like, it doesn't go into that place, though, that we're horrified, you know? I mean, I think...
No, although
it has
I'm
a
sure...
Familiarity
I have pictures like that, too, but, you know, I don't... Yeah. You know, I'm just being...
Yeah.
And we can kill that slide now, if you would, so...
I'm curious. Mm. You know that clutter book that's the bestseller clutter book, the... What's it called? Yeah.
I've never heard of it.
What do you think of her?
She came out, her book came out right after I turned in my book. So I went ahead and I figured I have to deal with it. So I went ahead and read it. And then I wrote an article about her for The New Yorker Online. Because I poked around in her history in Japan to see what her from. And it was very interesting to discover what her background was. I don't want to take time here to talk about it, but if you go online and you see Marie Kondo, my name, you'll see the article. It's very interesting. And I'm going to show a slide later of someone who is from Japan, who writes about design and stuff, who's totally anti-Marie Kondo. Mm. And it's very interesting, because she only represents one way of thinking in Japan. Her book, a lot of her book I found really not to my taste at all. And a lot of people who work with hoarders say the business about spark joy, the one thing we do when helping a hoarder is we don't give them stuff to look at and handle because we'll be there from now until the end of the universe. Yeah. At one point I did throw her book across the room because she said, if you have a book and you haven't read it in 3 months, you know,
right,
get rid of it. And I thought, are you joking with me?
To a writer.
Are you, you know, the writer Anatole France had a great thing. Someone said, oh, Monsieur France, you have all these tremendous library of books. Have you read every one? And Anatole France says, Madam, do you bring out your Sevres china, your fancy china, for every meal? Mm. No, I keep it there. Maybe at a certain point I'll get it. But it's special stuff, you know, it's special stuff. So, but the thing I think is Marie Kondo comes from a... I don't like the fact that she thinks that you have to have everything stripped down. I don't.
Right.
That's just a certain person. The thing that I think is useful is her, you know, she trained a little bit in a Shinto shrine. A lot of Japanese girls do. They work as assistants in a Shinto shrine. Shinto. Let's do the take again. Can we do it? And it's animistic. And there's tremendous sense of respect towards things. And her business about kissing the socks when you throw them out and stuff like that is, for me, I don't know about that exactly, but it's very important because what people need to be able to get rid of something is some kind of ceremonial gesture to give it. In my case, it was destroy it, right? But you don't. You say hail and farewell.
No.
Thank you for your company. And you can release that way. It's an emotional little transaction. Mm-hmm. And for that, I thought was useful and important. I just find the imperative to strip everything down.
Right. That's aesthetics, you know.
Well,
that's,
I mean,
personal.
I'll jump ahead and say this. I don't say this explicitly in the book, but in doing the book, I started out thinking, well, you know, I guess I should submit and you know, clean up all this clutter. And really. By the end of the book, I really felt... The world is designed, there are people in the world who really love objects more than other people do. Mm-hmm. There are people in the world who don't mind disorder as much as other people do. There are people in the world who don't mind a little bit of dust, who don't clean house as much. It's a personal thing. If you get to the point where the stuff is really interfering with your life, is having the landlord about to throw you in the street, then you do need to do something about it. And I can suggest what I think are helpful things. I think it takes a village. Doing it yourself, you've got yourself for a lawyer, you know. and it's very hard to do. You lose perspective. Mm-hmm. And solidarity really helps as we're learning as we go forward in life now. But my book is not a how-to guide. It's an exploration of a world and of a feelings, and it really... I started out thinking I was going to be writing a fishing guide, and I wound up sort of writing my own misshapen version of Moby Dick. And I honestly, I had a blast. And with Google at your disposal, the trouble is you can research and the trouble is learning how to.
Yeah.
There's a great advice that Woody Allen gave, quoting somebody, about how to make something, comedy writing. He quoted a wise man. Somebody wrote the wise man and said, the advisor, he said, what can I, you know, I got a script. It's not working. Can I show it here to give me some advice? And the guy said, sure, show it to me. I'll tell you right now. I don't have to look at it. Make it shorter. And I just heard that the other day when I was visiting a guy producing comedy, a TV comedy. I went to visit him on the lot. And he said we had troubles, it wasn't working, and then we decided to make it simpler and shorter. And that is the challenge in writing a book where you get all this, especially if you're interested in ephemera, the detail, the coincidences that I kept discovering in the book, like one world suddenly connects to another world in this amazing way. Amazing way. And you just think I could go on endlessly. And I don't know about you in fiction, but my girlfriend, who's a main character in the book,
and sets it in motion. And she sets it in motion.
It in motion, and she's constantly chipping in. But without her as my first and most important reader steering me in, I wouldn't have finished the book.
Yeah.
She would tell me things like, I'd say, oh my God, she said, how'd it go today? Well, I found this most amazing coincidence. And she would say, forget the coincidences, stick with,
focus.
So yeah. Sometimes I would say, but you don't understand, this is amazing, rich stuff here. Mm. Amazing, rich stuff here.
Which then, I mean, it's, two things. One quick aside, just because I think it's really funny, is the Kondo, that's her name, right? The Marie Kondo. So her statement of like, you hold each object to see if it gives you joy, or hold each piece
spark
of clothing,
joy,
or whatever,
yes.
Spark joy. But there's a real, those of you that have watched Transparent, there's just this moment that I think is so funny in the first season where the mother character has a new boyfriend and she's cleaning up her apartment and she's all excited by the new relationship. And I can't remember his name, if anyone remembers his name. But she's like, it's like Bugsy or something. She's like, Bugsy has this great statement where he says, pick up anything and if it doesn't spark joy, throw it away. And it's that great thing too of like something in the culture gets inhabited by someone and cluttering mode. It's just so real.
The Japanese bookstore in Manhattan, Kinokuniya, which is here too, wanted to put us together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But
that
would have been
by
an
that
interesting
time,
pairing.
Ms. Kondo was,
Yeah. Yeah,
a movie star
whizzing
around.
It's sweeping the country, but so you also say early on, and I kind of wanted to add too that I came to Barry's work many years ago in Wearing Dad's Head, which is your first book,
second book,
and there are all these very short pieces, often in present tense, and they're kind of surreal, strange, dreamlike moments, and I've used them in teaching for years, and they're amazing, and they're poetic and beautiful, and they're very different than this book, and this book is wonderful too, but so different. You talk about removing the costume. Like, what if you do writing where you take away the magic, the overt magic of kind of a kid wearing his father's head, actually, and the father's asleep, he's alive, but it's this incredible story. I totally recommend finding it by the creek. And writing this, it felt like, I'm curious just about writing process briefly on that. Like, what was that shift like? Because it felt very natural.
Very frightening, actually, because I write sort of surreal, like invented dream stuff. They're very confessional.
Yeah.
They're actually based on authentic issues in my life. But yeah. I can use the mask of surrealism, of fantasy, to disguise that it's, myself. And you can't do that in a memoir, ostensibly. And also, you're restricted to things that exist in the world that you write about. And you're, in my work as a fiction writer, I would improvise, and I also, if I was stuck, as Raymond Chandler said, when you're a detective writer, you know, if you're stuck, you can always have a guy come in the door with a gun. And I would have an angel would fall out of the sky in my work or something, you know, or whatever. So I didn't have that way to go.
Yeah.
I also had to find emotion in a. There's something about writing fiction that's connected to. I think of my fiction as dream work, actually, because what are dreams? Dreams are just a way we have of talking about certain activities that are internal, that are not sort of in what seems conscious life.
Right.
So it seems to me that you can write fiction, which I think I do, because I also improvise a lot in making these stories, that works in the same territory as dreams. Yeah, it deals with these things that are under there, that are pushing along, that you don't want to acknowledge or, you know. So I didn't have that available to me as I sat down. So it was scary, but I decided if I could find comic notes in it, I would use those to help push the memoir along.
And that coincidence then becomes like a narrative tool too, right? Because you run into coincidences.
And especially you find yourself looking for, what I loved was eventually, because I worked as a newspaper reporter early on, and as a fact checker. At a magazine, and what you realize is that somebody presents you something, you say, oh, I wonder what's behind that, or what happens if I look up if there's, you know, for instance, I was throwing away something, and I decided to play a song to go along commemorating it. So I found this great Roy Rogers song. I was throwing out a piece of athletic equipment. It's in the book. I'll give it away. I was throwing out an exercise horse, and I thought, I'll play a Roy Rogers song. So I ran along and I found Roy Rogers singing a farewell to Trigger, or an homage to Trigger. So I'm going, I'm playing it, I'm dragging the thing, and I suddenly think, should we go for the bonus and see if Roy Rogers maybe was a hoarder? So I went and looked it up. This is the miracle of Google. I didn't have to go to a library and chase it down. And it turns out that Roy Rogers, child of the Depression, not everyone is this way, said, I am someone who kept every single thing in his life. And the Roy Rogers Museum, that I think used to be out here, or maybe it was in Oklahoma, there was a description of it that said, in today's world, Roy would be considered a hoarder. So these are the kind of thing, these are these kind of little kismets. And there were ones that were much more profound as I went along, as I went along in the book. And it was really, I don't know, it for me it gives this extra richness with this.
Yeah. Well, and it feels like then the real world is allowing you that dreamlike feeling that the previous fiction had a little bit. Like it surprises you and you can make these
links. And also, what it does is this. There's one of the things people talk about is what's called some people refer to as the endowment effect. In other words, if I hold this coffee mug and I say it's a lovely coffee mug from this great program, great. If I say Gabriel Marquez drank from this coffee cup, it's a different coffee cup, right? Hasn't changed materially or whatever. And there's a certain sense in which coincidences enable, like when you say this is Marquez's coffee cup, it means you're kind of touching history a bit, yeah? He becomes both, it both aggrandizes the coffee cup, but it also puts it in your level, so it becomes...
Humanizes him.
It humanizes, but it also makes it present in your world. You don't have to scale. It scales itself down, so it both scales up and scales down. Mm. And there's a certain way in which coincidences, where you get two worlds that seem to be disparate, suddenly meet, and you suddenly find, yes, the experience is this continuum. It's not like we exist in the present that looks like this, and the past is... another country that is maybe imagined. No, it's all the continuum of actuality. Mm. And that was really powerful and exciting.
Yeah. There's this line that you said to your Lacanian analyst, I feel like what I'm doing here is constructing a poem of myself. And you were referencing therapy, right?
Right.
But it also feels like the book is like that too, in that, well, you're doing a couple things. There's a poem of yourself, and the excavating is revealing all these things about you, but you're also thinking about it culturally too. in all these different ways that this has come up, and how other, you know, Clutter is anonymous and coming into other people. So like their contact with their objects, what they're doing with it, how we all are contending with
it is. It
that.
Is. One. I mean, yeah. I started out the book, I mean, before the book began, as very suspicious of psychoanalysis. I was a big fan of Alice Miller, when we were talking about the drama of the gifted child, yeah. Who started out as an analyst and became very skeptical about the whole relationship in psychoanalysis, the analyst as God interpreting the, you know. And then I discovered cognitive behavioral therapy, and some of these people who do it are very good, but it's a technique. It's not a worldview.
Right.
It's all about removing symptoms, essentially. That's what it's about. And I remember I sat down with Randy Frost, who co-authored this book that Randy Frost wrote, Stuff, which is a wonderful book. And she's the head of social work at Boston University. Her name is Gail Steckerty. And I said, you know, I really, you know, look forward to talking about this poem myself, sort of thing. And she said, well, listen, you want to talk about your problem or you want to do something about it? And I thought, well, can't I do both?
Right. Exactly.
The thing that I went and interviewed a guy named Darren Leader, who is one of the big literary psychoanalysts, public psychoanalysts in England. Almost frighteningly wise guy. Mm. I mean, wise man, you know, prodigiously intelligent, you know. He was actually, you know, that Nick Cave movie, 1,000 Days or whatever it's called. Nick Cave, the singer-songwriter, made a documentary about him, and he speaks with his analyst, and that's Darren Leader in the thing. Huh. And Darren Leader said, Darren Leader is a huge opponent of cognitive behavioral therapy, although he will sometimes recommend it if he thinks people need help, and it's a technique to help. But he said this, this is one of the two anchoring things in my book. He said, the human condition is this: you can really want something and really not want it at the same time.
Yeah.
So we work through this stuff. The other thing I loved in the book, and it's the enterprise of a writer going into any project, especially nonfiction, it was a piece of wisdom that was delivered mockingly. The screenwriter put it in John Barrymore's mouth in 20th Century. As a kind of pompous hope, but I love it. It is, the sorrows of life are the joys of art. Mm. And that was continuously in the book. Mm. Because if I would go into a setting where I was thrown out of my peer group for being a loudmouth. Okay. But as it was happening, I thought, this is gonna look good on the page. And it's funny, there's a wonderful writer, I was talking with Ken Brecker about him, Ken knows his work well, named Redmond O'Hanlon, who's this very eccentric Englishman, who's a natural historian, and he went with James Fenton into he does these hellaciously dangerous comic expeditions. He goes into the Amazon and eats crocodile into an area which is off the map, and, you know, at any minute he could perish. He goes into Borneo looking for some ape, you know, and again in an area where you're... And I said to him... And, you know, he lives outside of Oxford in a hoarded house. And I said to him, that's why I went to visit him. And I said to Redmond, how did you manage not to go crazy with fear in the middle of these things? And he said, I knew I was writing a book. I knew I was taking photographs. Mm. So it gave me a distance. Mm. It gave me a mechanism for me able to cope with it. And for me, being able to know I was writing the book so that things would happen, you know, I would also document everything. I took photos up the kazoo.
Yeah.
That's another thing that people hoard now is digital.
Yeah. And actually, we should, before we open it up to questions from the audience, you're going to show some of these photos.
Are we there now?
We're there.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through quickly just some illustrative photos of Clutter and what have you. Okay, this is what my place looked like at the beginning. This is what it looked like when I was done with the project. Wow. My girlfriend, who's a, you know, award-winning food writer, James B. Awards and all that stuff, insisted that I invite her to dinner and make dinner for her and her mother. I won't tell you how the dinner went. You'll have to read. But I must say. The Yelp reviews were pretty good. Okay, so now, this is Ryszard Kapuściński. I wanted to see how other writers operated with clutter. This is Ryszard Kapuściński, the great Polish fabricator, alas. But anyway, you can see, I showed his biographer pictures of my place. I said, does it compare to Kapuściński, you think? He said, oh, no, yours is much worse, much worse. Okay. This is our man of the library here, Ray Bradbury, who worked, I mean, this is just one picture. He worked his, he loves, obviously, toys. He loves to be surrounded by them. Mm. Other people might say, my God, this is the most cluttered space in the world. No. This is Auden. And I wrote about him also in the new an article about him and other writers who are clutterers. Notoriously messy man. Notoriously messy. When he tried to give away his couch when he moved back to England from St. Mark's Place in East Village, the Salvation Army said, are you joking? I wrote about this. Hemingway, another writer of Short Thing, was a complete paper hoarder.
Interesting.
This is just a little glimpse. He worked under just towering stacks of things. When George Plimpton went to visit him and interviewed him in the 50s for the Paris Review interview, he said, Hemingway is clearly a man who cannot throw anything away. Paper. And typically like a hoarder, I mean, the maid would come in and clean it. So that's something that means he's not fully a hoarder. But he'd have, what he did as a what hoarders will do is there were mixtures. He held on to every document practically that was ever issued to him. Every Christmas card apparently that ever came to was there, mixed in with like important, important living documents, you know. Mm. So this, you know, it was, and when he left Cuba, I went and visited his finca now. I was in Havana for a month. And his finca, this place where this is, it's completely crowded with his possessions, but it doesn't look like this. They cleaned it out. Mm. Yeah? But he had like, you know, the only things he would lend to throw away were three-year-old papers. He kept everything that just came up and wrote among towering stacks of stuff. Mm. This is another Japanese guy who's the counter to Aunt Marie Kondo. His name is Kyochi Suzuki. I wrote about him in the Kondo book. He wrote a book called Tokyo, A Certain Style. He's a journalist and whatever, which is a wonderful book about the tiny little spaces. When people say, oh, it's so Japanese to be minimalist, it is in some ways, in other ways it isn't. And this is from another book called Happy Victims. These are people in their small places who are devoted to collecting things, and they love it. Mm. And, I mean,
maximalist, yeah.
Exactly. For other people, it might be claustrophobic. This is a guy named Guatelli. I think that's the right name. Anyway, there's the museum outside there's a man who lived outside of Parma in Italy, and he collected the simple objects of everyday life. This is just one room. The other rooms are just, he just kept everything there, but he tended it, yeah?
Yeah,
he tended it.
Very much.
So I was very interested in the difference between collecting and hoarding, but also in the gray areas. Mm. Because both people love objects. They might say there's an intentionality that's different, whatever, in different ways. But this is Freud's desk. I went to Freud collected statue and whatever. This is Freud's desk in Hampstead, England. I went to visit it. As you can see, there's barely any room there to work on his table. These are his statuaries, which he called his old grubby gods. But I took a hoarding expert to visit, who was a psychologist, to visit Freud's place and say, why is Freud a collector and not a hoarder? I thought it was a clever little thing. And she gave him number one. She gave him a one on the clutter scale, not a zero, a one, because there's a lot of stuff. He liked objects. Hmm. Are we at the video yet? Okay, so this is Richard Wallace, the UK's most extreme hoarder, whom I videoed, in his house outside of London. This is a verse to his stuff.
Yes, it's recorded, please. Okay. It's a little ditty called When I'm Keeping Papers, sung to the tune of When I'm Cleaning Windows by George Formley. When I stack papers in my home, the pile gets very high, but then when it begins to lean and those on top start to fly, caught in time before they flew, I used a bit of 4x2. That is what I've had to do when I'm keeping paper. Very good.
The experience was totally shocking of his place. Hmm. Let me just, I've got two more to show, yeah? Hmm. We're just coming out of this into the... And if we can't get it, I'll describe what's in the... what we got here. Oh, okay. Two things. This guy's name is Dr. Barry Lubetkin. His father was in a bank deal. He's a shrink, a behaviorist, cognitive behaviorist. A really cool guy, like a Borscht Belt comedian. His father was an antiques dealer. He discovered, the reason I went to see him, he discovered he owns the face of the grandfather clock. That's a famous image of the Collier brothers. He owns it. I wanted to see it. It was in storage. He couldn't show it to me. It turns out he's a collector. Why is he a collector? He said because as a son of an antiques dealer, he would go to antique shows all the time, whatever, and he realized he would be engulfed by the attractiveness of all this fantastic world. So he decided he had to concentrate on a specific theme and just collect that stuff. So what does he collect? Psycho-collectibles, he calls them. All these, and what is great is he's got a copy of, an artist's copy of Freud's interpretation of dreams that has every single word in that book, only completely scrambled. So it's total gibberish.
Wow. So that's amazing.
But the thing that was interesting, I couldn't put in my book, and this is it. His brother was a stand-up comedian named Steve Lubetkin. And some of you may remember that when there was the comedy strike at the Comedy Store back in the day, this guy's brother jumped off the roof of the building next to the Comedy Store and committed suicide in the parking lot. Now, I found this out by researching, thank you, Google, and I was going to ask him, because Freud started collecting after his father died, people often start hoarding intensely in the wake of trauma. I was wondering, did anything change in your hoarding, in your collecting, with the death of your brother? But it was, okay. And let me end with this thing finally. What does the culture have to do with the accumulation of objects? Okay, I'm going to show you this. This is the website of Oprah. She had on a guest. She does shows about hoarding. The guest is a guy named Dr. David Tolan. He's giving the listing of symptoms, this is a few years ago, of what constitutes hoarding. The pop-up ad says, splurge on you and your home now. And this is a screenshot I took. And that is the double message that is in this culture. Yeah. Thank you all for coming. Mm.
And they'll do questions. They'll be coming around with mics for questions.
Culturally speaking, is there a history of hoarding that began with a trauma, cultural trauma?
That's a good question. Hoarding is, I mean, there are instances of hoarding, but what really makes hoarding is that it's not just accumulating valuable stuff. It's accumulating stuff that society thinks is not that valuable. Like, why are you keeping this old piece of crap? Why don't you throw it out? Why are you keeping all these moldy magazines? Why don't you throw that out? So that was, to me, an important distinction. Jay Leno has how many cars? He's a car collector. How many cars do you need? I mean, billionaires have how much money? Mm-hmm. The important thing was that something is not intensely valuable. I would say, starting with the onset of capitalism in France, very cheap objects, artish collectible objects, were started to be produced. Mm. Bibelot, yeah, and that started people starting to be able to collect things. In literature, the first instance I would say really is in Gogol's Dead Souls, where there's a guy who goes around the neighborhood and picks up old trash and brings it home and keeps it there. And his name was Plyushkin, the character. And in Russia, people who hoard are people who said suffering from Plyushkin disorder. But I think in all cultures across the world, apparently, according to Randy Frost, people do hoard. In the Soviet Union, in places where it was really hard to get goods, there are people who would lock doors. You can't, you know, they won't let you in because the stuff is just piled to the ceiling. So
I'm trying to say, like, the thing of consumerism in America or in the Western world, is there a relationship between hoarding and consumerism?
There is a certain one, but it's not exclusive. There is, but it's not exclusive. I will say this guy like Randy Frost, I mean, not Randy Frost, Richard Wallace, really feels that he's striking against the disposable culture. So why should we throw out, why should I throw out a perfectly usable or rescuable object if, in this disposable country, I want to respect, it's wasteful. I don't want to be wasteful. Which led him to keep 18 broken umbrellas because they might be fixed. Or in his case, broken light bulbs because there was a machine that could then, and I said to him, but, Richard, that's about the most labor-intense thing I've ever heard. You know, why don't you, I understand these things are unfortunate, but this is the kind of thinking that goes on.
Interesting.
Next question?
Two quick things. You know, as you said, there's a lot of gray areas to this. So I do suppose people can fall in love with, as you said, a piece of ephemera or an item and just want it for themselves. But then people can fall in love with the experience of who they are when they found that piece of ephemera, like you said, visiting a restaurant and drinking out of the cup and having to have that cup because a famous author drank out of it. So that's like constructing a life for yourself through only the objects that you need to have. And so my question for you is, when you were living amongst this huge hoard of items, if you had walked through your apartment, would you know every single item and what it was and when you got it? Would there be a story about it for yourself? And secondarily, I'm sure there's a tremendous amount that's been written about writers who must write in the eye of a hurricane, who love being surrounded by a maelstrom in order to find a place where they can write, such as the photographs of many of the writers that you showed us in their workspace.
Those are all really interesting. I would say yes. The one about the writers and the maelstrom, I'm not so sure, but the first one about walking through and seeing, having the histories of each item being there, absolutely. As a matter of fact, it's a common thing for people, it's common among people who clutter and whatever, or collect a lot of objects, even real collectors, is that the objects, even though they're part of an aesthetic, what have you, bring with them the history of the encounter, of the chase, of the purchase. And for me, in the same way in a little bit now digital photographs works, they are archives of my passage through the world. That's why the Marie Kondo things to me seem so impoverished. I don't want just something that is narrowed to, does it spark joy? It's like someone said, if you love a sports team, you don't just simply display the trophies and forget everything else. You know, when you go through the history. As someone said of the Boston Red Sox before they won, they were always losers. They said, the point of the Boston Red Sox isn't that you win trophies or championships, is that you make history. And so one of the things that all these objects do is like an archive of my emotional history and of my experience in the world. And they all are rich with that. You know, the thing that does become difficult, and it's common for people's lives, I often can't find stuff. Now, I will say this. I don't want to give it away. You read the book, and you read. I don't want to give away punchlines here. Yeah.
What if your place went up in flames? What would your reaction be? Of course, you cleaned it up now, but would there be a sense of relief at some level, or maybe not just for you because you cleaned it up, but maybe another hoarder?
No, I understand that, and that's a question also that this. That's a standard. An orthodox question that people say, how would you feel if you lost it all? Honestly, so if I had my druthers, I would cap the stuff I have in a lovely little storage area. I could go visit it. I like as a writer having just, you know, for years, I wasn't always, you know, I'm living in this way now, in I would say, good enough decluttering. That's what I believe in, yeah? You know, it's good enough decluttering, you know, as good enough mothering from...
Exactly.
You know, exactly. So it's good enough decluttering, you know, and I'm happy, I'm able to be social with this stuff. If a tempest took it all away... Tempests have a way of cleaning all sorts of things, you know. But I would feel like, in certain ways, I'd lost some of my place in the world with certain documents. Not everything, but certain documents, photos, books, certain books, you know. Certain things that are rich with that are tokens of an experience. That I would grieve over. Because... somebody, Eric Fromm or somebody, said there are types of personalities who or even Sartre, I'm not sure, things are not just sort of, you know, things are not just all expressions of capital or consumerism, you know. Things are help us inhabit the world, you know. Organizing things, displaying things, being attracted to things, I mean, it's culture. The thing I was interested in, and some other time we talk about it, was there's a concept from Winnicott in psychoanalysis of the transitional object, you know, the security blanket, whatever. And I found that constantly being something that was I was being reminded of, and people talk about their things, as I was the author who kept coming back to mind as I dealt with people who hoarded and so on, was Borges. Mm. People would say things that came straight out of a Borges story. Mm. I would look in amazement. Mm. They would just express an idea. I thought, but wait a minute, that's Borges' story about, you know, the map that covers the world. You know, because people who hoard or have a tendency that way are not able to edit. Mm. So there's no summarizing. It's just everything is, you know, is there, that's there. This guy, Richard Wallace, told me, I said, do you ever think of keeping a diary, a chronicle, like, you know? And he said, well, you know, the thing is, I would, but, you know, it would take a day to write about the previous day, and then, you know, I thought...
I'm really interested in this paperless generation, if maybe they were raised with a different aesthetic. And I've started using the term computer hygiene in not quite the way I think computer hygiene, the term, is intended. So could you talk about that digital hoarding and maybe the intergenerational viewing of computer
yeah,
hygiene?
It's very interesting because we are, unless there's somebody here under 16, we are a generation that's a bridge generation, yeah? I mean, I still cannot read anything that's important to me online. I have to print it out or I need the book, you know. The digital thing, I'm at least a digital clutter bug, if not something beyond, more intense. My cell phone camera is constantly got 6,000 pictures on it. But I can be ruthless about it, but it also occupies, as I say, it's like a chronicle. It's like an archive of my moments. I will look at a picture and I remember exactly where I was. We have the capacity to do that now. Yeah, we didn't have that before. The other thing I like to say is, how did people ever manage to eat in restaurants before cell phones? But yes, I think the other thing is, how many people here have bookmarks up the kazoo, as they say? I do. There's a tendency now to read only the headlines, yeah, because you'll come back to it later. So it's a tricky thing. Sometimes I wrote all my fiction early. I always write longhand for fiction, and I typed it. The first book I typed on a manual typewriter. What it did was, it gave weight to the individual word. Mm. The computer encourages flow. Yeah. Someone said that's a few true. Years ago, when computers are really starting to be used, how come all these people are sending manuscripts to editors and they're all 7,000 pages long? What happened? And they said, because of the computer. Just goes, yeah. You know, psh. Yeah. So it's an interesting. Other people say, just let me. Other people say there's a wonderful person who writes about this stuff who teaches Italian studies at NYU and had a blog called "If I Were a Hoarder." Her father's a hoarder, and she thinks that hoarding is a response to the evanescence of digital culture. But I think, in a way, you get into this habit of accumulation on the digital stuff. So I can't help think there's some echo in your actual behavior, because you get used to having just many, many alternatives. Mm. Yeah.
Hi. I noticed in your images they were all of men. I'm wondering if you've discovered any sort of gender-based differences in styles of hoarding or the kinds of things that are done or in different professions. As an artist, you know, I meet a lot of collectors, and collectors make museums, and museums make people happy. And also, thinking about gender questions, but also thinking about, you know, you mentioned Jay Leno's car collection, and one of the things that comes to mind is the socioeconomics of accumulation. You know, what looks like a hoard of things in a New York City apartment. If I look at like my small home, you know, in Northeast LA, it's not really filled. But if I tried to put that into a studio apartment in Tokyo, I would be a hoarder, right? So I'm interested in that. You know, like, does socioeconomics fit into how we define what people are, in a sense? Mm,
yeah. To the last part, just quickly, is no. All income groups do it. You have more capacity, like the end of Citizen Kane, where, you know, the stuff is just piled. But I was in a group where someone filled the house with empty pizza boxes. So that, you know, so that's what they had.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me?
The difference between hoarding and collecting, like,
is a very interesting thing. And yeah. There is a difference, but then it's amazing how you scratch a collector sometimes and you say, but does everything look like, does everything look like it's in the display cases or what's, you know, and then you go poking behind and whatever. But let me finish. In fact, they're split. It's equal. Women will tend to seek out help. Men won't. That's a critical thing. In terms of what they collect, I'm sure there's a difference, you know. But that was the interesting thing, because I asked. I said, is it? It also skews the to age. Older people, the population of people who hoard are much, partly because they've lived much longer. But there's also something about people at the end. Roz Chest, in her memoir, Let's Talk About Something Else, More Pleasant, or whatever, dealt with her old parents. We did an evening together. It was wonderful. And she was saying, she would come and they say, but why are you keeping this mold deal? And they said, don't touch that. So there's this guy, Darren Leader, the psychoanalyst, and then I guess we should, this was so respectful. He said, symptoms, you know, first of all, actually I'll end with this. We're all crazy. A famous psychologist said, the issue is to not go crazy. So, that's what makes us human. Anyway, thank you all so much.
Thank you both so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.